Hi there, it's Bob Surratt.
And Marianne Murciano. Hello.
Well, let's get to some business first. Nationally known expert on personal finance, the markets, and the economy, Terry Savage joins us, as she does every week. Let's get to the president's proposals first. He called for sweeping tax increases yesterday, and let's get your take on things, Terry.
Yeah, you know what? It quickly devolves into the political when you talk about this budget. So let me take one quick step backward, and let's just clarify a couple of facts, some terms. The president said that the deficit was cut in half since he came into office. We need to understand the difference between the annual budget deficit and our national debt. Now, it is absolutely true that in 2009, we had a $1.4 trillion budget deficit for that year. And this year, it's expected that the budget deficit will be, quote, only about give or take $450 billion, maybe give or take 10 or 20 billion. And I think of Everett Harris, as do all of you who remember, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. But the fact is,
so it is about half or something like that?
No, that's the annual deficit. However, every single year for the past 6 years, and certainly farther than that, since the Clinton era was the last time we had a balanced budget, every year we have added to the national debt, which is officially now said to be $18 trillion. So when you add a half a trillion this year of $450 billion, and last year is close to $500 billion, you're still adding to our national debt.
What's the difference between the deficit and the debt?
Thank you. I couldn't have posted a better question. The deficit is the budget deficit every single year. The amount we go over, the money we borrow to make up the difference for that 1 year, the annual deficit of what the government spends and what it takes in tax revenues. But the fact is, though, the deficit on an annual basis has been coming down. It's like saying, you folks out there are terrible consumers. Last year, you borrowed $100,000 on your credit cards. This year, you're only borrowing $50,000. You're much better. Wait, you're still adding to your total outstanding debt. And our national debt is now $18 trillion if you don't take into account obligations for Social Security and retirement benefits, Medicare, and so forth down the road. So it's a little disingenuous to say that we're going in the hole less every year when we're still going in the hole by a huge amount every year. Okay?
And that's not to be confused with the debt, though, right?
Right. The debt, our $18 trillion worth of IOUs outstanding, some of which are owned by you and your money market fund, a lot of which are owned, about $3 trillion of that, by the Social Security Trust Funds. You didn't think there was really money sitting there. They're special purpose IOUs from the government. And a lot of which is owned by foreign central banks, including China and Japan, which combined own almost $3 trillion of our IOUs. After all, we buy stuff from China or Japan. We pay for it in dollars. Their companies translate it into yen. Then the government says, what are we going to do with all this? We'll just go buy IOUs from the government. So we have a lot of creditors. Money market funds, you buy treasury bills, foreign central banks. Now, I want to bring this closer to home in your wallet. Has anybody out there noticed that treasury bills, on which all kinds of savings rates are based, are like at 0.07%? In other words, the government is practically paying nothing in interest to all the people who buy treasury bills, because everybody in the world says, I don't want to be in euros, I don't want to be in yen, I want to be in the safety of U.S. dollars. If we were in, let's just call it ordinary, if we can define ordinary times, and if the Fed weren't keeping interest rates very low, which we are all feeling, those of us who have savings and thought we'd get some interest, if they weren't keeping those rates low, then the interest bill every year on the national debt would soar. Now, right now, interest is the third largest category behind social spending like Social Security and Medicare and defense. And this year, we will pay $221 billion in interest on all that money outstanding. That's because you and I are, the Fed's making rates low. What if interest rates went up? If interest rates went up, why? Because the government had to bribe people to come lend to us, or because the Fed said, wait a minute, we should let interest rates go up. This is very artificially low. Then our interest bill on the national debt would soar. It could double or triple. It's estimated that within a few years that will happen. And plus all the additional debt we're adding, we'd be paying $1 trillion in interest a year on the debt just an interest on that 18 and climbing trillion dollar national debt.
Which
are MIGO numbers. I have a friend who says that means my eyes glaze over.
Yeah, know? Exactly.
But it's a big issue.
Mm-hmm. What? Why is it? I'm picking something out that you just said,
okay,
that people still around the world are still feeling like dollars is where they feel safe. How could anybody feel safe?
You and I should take our show on the road.
Debt and deficit.
That has been the largest question, except when you look at all the alternatives. I mean, well, you don't want to be in rubles, Russian rubles, okay? We know we don't want to be in Venezuelan, I think it's
definitely not
currency,
whatever.
Because, you know, I mean, they're just printing money like crazy. Russia's having its own problems. Oh, a lot of people used to be in euros. But wait a minute. What if Greece drops out? What if it doesn't drop out? Will they have to forgive the debt? So the value of the euro has been crashing. Oh, Canadian dollars. One of my favorite things for a long time. But wait a minute. Oil prices are down. Canada's going to have some economic problems. Don't want to be in Canada. In fact, the Canadian dollar has fallen about 15 to maybe 20% against the U.S. dollar over the last year. So you don't want to be in Japanese yen. They're just announced they're printing more of them. So the least worst place to have your money is in the U.S., even though our interest rates are relatively low.
So what you're saying is we're the tallest midget.
Something like that. I've heard cleanest shirt in the laundry. You know, you don't have any more clean shirts, so you go through which one is the least dirty to put on. And that's what's so weird about the global financial system now. The Australians just cut their interest rates and so forth. So the U.S., forget even raising rates, and they're low, is already a magnet for currencies from around the world.
Well, all this talk about interest rates are going to go up, all this just makes me feel like, why would it? I mean, it would all across the board.
Yes, that would attract more money here, make our dollar stronger, make it tougher for us to export.
But our interest rate would go up.
And the Fed's kept rates low. It hasn't really spurred the economy that much. I don't think you can argue that any economic recovery we've had has been so much spurred by low rates. People are afraid still to go out and get mortgages at the lowest all-time rates. The Fed has managed to keep our interest bill on the national debt relatively low. How'd you like to pay credit card interest rates on $18 trillion? The average credit card rate is over 15%. A lot of people are paying 29%
interest bad
a
enough.
Year.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So is this a I know it sounds like a big global complex problem, but I would tell you it is. But the fact is that it impacts you and me personally, because if you're a saver, you don't get interest. You don't get the interest you thought you would have at this point. The federal government continues to rack up deficits every year. They're just not as big as the deficits we saw in the height, or the depths, I should say, of the 2009 recession. And the question is, here's the big political question, how do you get more money into the government? Do you get it by raising taxes? Or do you get it by reorganizing the tax code? Do you get it by economic growth? Or do you get it by taking away from the people who have and giving to the people who don't, and thinking that the government can create growth?
Depends who you talk to.
Exactly. It's the political debate.
Hang on. It's more from Terry Savage momentarily. I want to get to gas prices and also the tax return to-do list to double check for 2014's return. That and more coming up. Terry Savage with us. Are we done solving the economic problems of our country?
Yeah, it occurred to me that there's a wonderful website, truthinaccounting.org. It's a Chicago-based organization. I think I agreed to join their advisory board. On the homepage, truthinaccounting.org, there's one of those countdown clocks, the U.S. national debt and the truth debt. The national debt is $18 trillion, and it keeps ticking away. Then the real truth, with all those things we really are going to owe down the line that are so scary, is now $83,130,579,000,000.
You can't even say the number.
Yeah, it's clicking too fast.
Yeah.
Truthinaccounting.org.
A senior petroleum analyst the other day said, depending on global politics, the weather, and anything else that's unforeseeable, we could see gas prices remain high from May to August. You think that's true?
You know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I'll just tell you I've been around for a while, and here are the things I always know. that no matter what the level of gas prices, there's always a reason for gasoline prices to go up, no matter what level, mm-hmm. in the summer months when driving. You know, it's the change over to the summer blend. It's yeah. the octane. It's the this. It's the that. That's number one.
It always seems to happen before we hit the road for a holiday weekend.
And no matter what's going on in the macro market. And number two, here's another savage truth. Gasoline prices go down very slowly, but they bounce back very quickly based on the numbers you see in the crude market. I'm looking, I'll get you the latest on oil. It's up a couple of dollars a barrel today. It's $52.37 West Texas, okay, above $52. As why, by the way? I mean, what really happened in the world? Well, all of a sudden, all the major oil companies are saying, we're going to cap these wells. We're not going to drill that. We're not going to expend money. So they're looking beyond the valley of, oh, my goodness, there's a big supply now. And there is a huge supply. We can see it in the storage figures to, uh-oh, down the road, there won't be because everybody's going to stop drilling, which is also not true. So at any rate, those two things combine to tell you that you should enjoy the savings you're getting now. I don't have to be a soothsayer to predict that on Memorial Day or by 4th of July, gasoline prices will be higher than they are today.
Okay.
A lot higher?
And I don't think they'll be dramatically higher unless something happens in the world. But I think they'll be higher because there's no way we want to get on the road.
Okay. Tax time now. And I was looking at something in the Wall Street Journal the other day about investment losses. You can use your capital losses to offset capital gains, correct?
Okay, so anybody who's investing inside a 401k or an IRA doesn't have to worry about capital gains or losses on stocks because that money just keeps piling up or dipping down inside your retirement plan. And when you take it out, it will be all taxes, ordinary income, unless it's a Roth IRA. But if you invest in stocks or other assets outside your retirement plan, and you hold them long enough, you get a lower rate. How low a rate? Well, let's just see what happens with the president's budget. He's planning to, or asking Congress to, I'm not sure it'll get done, boost the capital gains tax rate to 28%. So first you offset long-term gains against any long-term losses you might have been hanging on. That real loser in your portfolio, if you're going to sell stocks outside your plan, today's a gain, to minimize your gains. If you're a trader, then you already probably know the rules. Short-term gains are ordinary income, but you can offset gains against losses. And if somehow, despite the fact that the market's up dramatically, you've managed to accumulate some capital losses, short term, you can offset $3,000 of those losses against ordinary income and carry the rest forward. I'm not a tax accountant. Mm-hmm. Speak to your own accountant about your own personal situation. But taxes should be the biggest problem you have on gains, although it's not a good idea to tax people's incentive to take risk and build business. And because it's not just stocks, you sell businesses at gains. Other assets.
Yeah, and then, by the way, I saw, what did it say here in the
journal?
You're reading the journal
cover to cover, aren't
you? Warning, you cannot deduct a loss on the sale of your personal residence.
No, you cannot. But you do get to exclude, if you own it singly, $250,000 worth of gains. And a married couple or owned jointly anyway, a property owned jointly, each owner can deduct up to $250,000 of gains. That's something interesting about one of the president's proposals. He backed down, by the way, on the taxing 529 savings plans. But one of the things he hasn't, I don't think so far, backed down on is the step up in taxes at death. So let's just say you bought your house in the suburbs in 1974 for $219,000, and you're still living there now in your 70s or 80s, and it's worth over $1 million, and that happens a lot, even with home prices down. You're thinking, gee, if I die in this home, there'll be no capital gains tax at all. My wife and I are over the $500,000 level. We've been living here for 40 years. Your kids get it with a cost as of the date of your death, or stocks you've owned outside your retirement plan. The president's proposal is to take away that step up at death and, in effect, tax all the gains on your assets to middle-income families, as if the cost were the cost on the date you bought it. So that's one of these proposals that's supposedly taxing the rich. But just because you lived in your home in Wilmette for 39 years or 42 years or something like that, and it's tripled in price, you shouldn't be owing taxes on that at your death. Or you bought IBM stock in 1971, and you know, it's your heirs that will pay that tax.
Is that going to stick?
I don't know. I think that'll be one of the tough ones because that doesn't tax the rich. That really hits middle class people who've done the right thing and It just didn't move and take gains every 2 or 5 years on their house.
To be continued at terrysavage.com, where you've got a post about healthcare sign-up made easy,
yes, don't
right?
forget healthcare sign-up, not less than 2 weeks now for the deadline. You have had some great commercials here about how to sign up, or go to the one of the websites, ehealthinsurance.com or the government website. Get it done. Do not wait another 10 days. It's a project for tomorrow.
Good advice, as always, from Terry Savage.
Thank you, Terry.
Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Market metrics and the latest headlines. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Let's get to one of the hosts of The Big Payoff on WGNplus.com, entrepreneur expert Suzanne Muchen. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hey. Hi, Bob and Marianne.
Let's talk a little bit about one of your favorite topics, women. First of all, the Super Bowl ads that everybody's been talking about for the past couple of days featured one that I know you like that effectively sold products to females. What's this all about?
So it's hard for businesses to do it right on the Super Bowl. We all know that. Especially hard when the pressure is to not only tell a great brand story, but to try to make people feel something. And the company who really hit it out of the park, which I know is the wrong analogy to use with the Super Bowl, I'm mixing sports metaphors, my apologies.
It's allowed.
But always put their Throw Like a Girl campaign right top of the Super Bowl, and it had such an unbelievable impact because it made people stop and think about how we're treating girls and how when we say things like throw like a girl, we're being demeaning to girls when young girls actually don't think about themselves that way. It was thought-provoking, smart, wise, and a great brand connection for women.
I loved that commercial for that same exact reason, and I so often hear it said to we have a daughter who's very athletic, and it's
exactly.
Such a backhanded compliment because she'll be told, oh, you don't throw like a girl.
But you know what? In this
exactly.
day and age, really, with all the great female sports that we have now and that we watch, is that still prevalent, really?
Yes.
Well, yes, it sure is. And what I loved about the way they approached this ad is they said, it's really not about sports. It's really not even about girl role models in sports. It's about the way we train boys and girls to think differently about what they're capable of doing just by the language that we use. It was so powerful. I mean, I hope you felt. I felt like my kids who were watching really mm-hmm. got it.
Yeah, no, I think it was very effective. And also something else that women are going to be happy about. And in fact, Suzanne, I cut this little article out for Marianne. I forgot to give it to her. I'm glad you want to talk about the new Virgin Hotel in Chicago, because Richard Branson really has done some things that cater to women. And what jumped out at me, and what I know Marianne is going to love hearing about, is better lighting, right?
Okay, so Marianne, I'm going to take Bob on this. Feel free to either defend him or join me on this topic, okay? Bob, here's the thing. I'm all for a hotel that caters to women. That's great. But women have a lot more at stake, especially women business travelers, than just better lighting in their vanities or a shelf for them to put their leg on when they shave.
Well, but that's not everything. But I hear Marianne complaining about the lighting all the time, especially in these new cool hotels.
Yeah, the boutique hotels that are new and cool, they have no space for anything. I mean, it could be for Bob's shaving kit or whatever. There is no space. And lighting, I'm putting on makeup in the dark as well as brushing my teeth in the dark, which is something Bob does as well.
But I get what you're saying, Suzanne. So what's Branson supposed to do? Say, well, we haven't listened to women. We're not going to do these things?
No, and I just want to note that Marianne did take your side.
I'm sorry. I'm okay. You know why? Because we've been staying in hotels lately, and that is my complaint always. Like, I'm always saying, I can't see anything.
I didn't even realize she did that. I'm so not used to that.
So I'm with you on that, but I want to answer Bob's question about what should they have done.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen Virgin and Richard Branson paint a more nuanced and holistic image of the women they were trying to attract. So, for example, what about saying, we know that a lot of you are needing better technology in the rooms because you've got a big presentation the next morning. And guess what? We've got better technology, more bigger screens for you to use in the room to practice your presentation in the morning. And we also have a better vanity and better lighting. Give us a more respectful, nuanced version of what women are actually in need of when they travel, particularly for business.
That I agree with that, because you're not just isolating the vanity. But I think
exactly.
That the vanity is it. I mean, it is a problem for men as well.
I do. Here was another feature of the hotel that I actually did like. You know how when you sit up in bed or you try to do work or read something as you're going to sleep at night, it's really uncomfortable?
Right.
They're giving in every room what's called a, quote, boyfriend or a husband, which is that big pillow that you put behind you that kind of curves that holds your body upright and helps you work better in bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I heard about that. I thought that was good, too. And you know, Richard Branson kind of sex appeal has been a big part of the aura around him and his company, right? So I think what you're talking about is the way he presented the grand opening of the hotel with the models and the red coats,
exactly,
welcoming people and so forth. And then you put that together with the better lighting for the vanities and the bench and the shower for shaving,
yep,
your legs. And that's why you got a little upset. I get it.
Now you're seeing my point of view.
I get it.
Bob.
Okay,
there
all right.
Go.
Point well taken. Before we let you go, let's talk about the news over at Land's End.
So I loved this. You know, one of the things we talked about last week on the show is what's needed to get more women in the pipeline. I think Marianne asked the question, what do we need to do to get more girls and more women to consider business as a career? And this is just a great example where Edgar Huber, who's stepping down as CEO, was not replaced by another typical guy. You know, we all think of it, Land's End, as that kind of outdoorsy brand where maybe they'd have a CEO who was sort of conservative and rough and tumble. But they pulled this woman, Federica Marchioni, who is the former president of Dolce & Gabbana and is fantastic. She's smart. She came from Ferrari before Dolce. She's young. She's very involved in the HuffPost. She's just a great role model for women. I love this choice.
More on WGNplus.com, The Big Payoff with Suzanne Muchin. Interesting stuff.
I wonder if the Land's End merchandise is going to resemble Dolce & Gabbana a little bit more now.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Thanks. Great to talk to you.
Okay, good to talk to you.
More on the Wintrust Business Lunch coming up on 720 WGN.
Go ahead, Orion, say it. We love these pickup trucks.
We love these pickup trucks.
All right. Yeah, it's official. Thank you. Here's a young mover and shaker you're going to want to meet. And you may have heard about Legacy Box. That is the way you can get your old pictures and VHS tapes stored properly and digitized. And the man behind that operation, Legacy Box founder Nick Mako, joins us from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hi, Nick. How you doing?
Hi there.
I'm doing very good. Thank you for having me today.
It's a great idea, Legacy Box. Talk about the genesis of it.
Yeah, I mean, we've been operating sort of in this space in the industry, helping families all across the country preserve all their home movies and shoeboxes of photos and albums and you name it for about a decade. And the genesis of Legacy Box was how do we make this process even simpler, and how do we reach people wherever they might be with a real simple solution? So the idea behind it, one of the biggest pain points people had was, you know, packaging, shipping, dropping it off at the post office, pricing was complicated. And so we just thought, how do we make it really, really simple so you could just give one to your mom and dad, or you could give one to your grandma and grandpa and say, here, fill this up, and they'll take care of the rest. So that was sort of the thought.
Explain how it works. What is it that you buy, and what do you get with this?
Sure. I mean, Legacy Box has several different packages, so it's ranging from like a starter up to a full collection. And basically, you pay for the entire thing. So you pay for the box as well as the service that we provide, which is converting all those items into digital keepsakes like DVDs or digital files. And so you purchase the box and it comes to you, and you just fill it up for whatever prepaid amount that you've already purchased, or you can add more items if you'd like. And then there's a FedEx shipping label in there, and slap that on the package, and then we take care of the rest.
It's a great idea. You say you've been doing this for a decade, so you were early. Yeah. You were early on this, young man, weren't you?
we were. My business partner actually was the first guy to start doing this, and he was kind of a video geek, and he thought, you know, my own family's home movies are stuck on all these tapes. How do we get these preserved on a digital medium that'll be around for a lot longer? And so he started doing it just as a hobby, and then we met up in college, and the rest is history.
So the idea is to make it easy to go into your closet and then take out all those reels, all those Super 8 or whatever it is, whatever format you have goes right inside this box, and then you pay a one-time charge. So what is your pricing like? What's a small box?
Yeah.
What's a medium box? What's a large box?
Sure. Our beginner, our starter legacy box is $75, and everything's included in that. So the shipping, the packaging, you name it, as well as the service. And it includes up to three items, so three home movie reels or three VHS tapes, or we say three packs of 25 photos. So let's say you had 25 slides or 25 negatives or 25 prints or whatever that might be. So it's three items for that starter kit, and it's $75, and then they go up to our most popular kit, which is the collection, and that one's $500. And I think you're catching me off guard here, but I think it includes 20 items, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken.
So that's all, that's a lot of items. I mean, like that's if you have a reel-to-reel tape, those things can be super long, and then you digitize them and return them in what format?
They get DVDs, so you get DVDs that you can watch on your television, and then we also include digital copies. So those digital copies you can load on your computer, and you could say edit that. You could share a clip on Facebook. You could store it on the cloud. Do what you want with the digital copy as well.
Nick, were you one of those kids who had the best Kool-Aid stand in the neighborhood when you were like 9?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I'm as a kid, I made my own comic books, and I remember being a middle schooler trying to cold call Nike, trying to sell the CEO on some shoe designs that I had come up with. So
wow,
yeah, I've been at it for a long time. I never actually got a hold of the Nike founder.
Day he's going to buy one of your boxes, Nick.
I hope so.
And Nick, you're still in your 20s, right?
I'll be 29 on the 11th of this month.
Yeah.
And actually, my wife and I just welcomed two twin boys this past September. So I'm a new dad as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
There you go. That's your best product, no question. I know people are going to want to get in touch with you and find out more about Legacy Box. How do they do that?
Just visit the website, legacybox.com, and we have everything on there. You can reach out to us through phone or web chat or email or you name it.
Yeah, great.
We love this, and we want to send you some of our own stuff.
I look forward to it.
Appreciate getting your story or a little bit of it. Nick Mako, Legacy Box. Congratulations and continued
Thank
success,
you
Nick. Okay.
I
See you down
it.
The road, I hope. Bye-bye.
Okay.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Bob Sirott and Marianne Murciano on 720 WGN.
We'll get a better handle on the weather and an update on the snow predictions when we talk to Tom Skilling. We'll do that at about 1:37 today.
I hope we don't get a lot of snow.
No, because
like
I got
yesterday.
The car finally cleaned off.
Yes. What did you do to finally get the car cleaned
Actually,
off?
It just fell off by itself. I was parked somewhere, and then I heard a big noise, and I turned around, and a giant iceberg slid off the car.
Were you on the highway?
No. I was parked somewhere.
You are a danger to society.
I know.
And
I did that for reasons of, the National Safety Council asked me to show what not to do.
Yeah, right.
And that's why people are so upset.
People are upset. I posted the video on our Facebook page of what it's like to ride with you. And some people were making comments like, why didn't I get out of the car? and get it off?
Yeah.
Good question. I don't do snow. I do everything that is indoors, but I don't do snow. That's your job.
You can see what we're talking about if you go to facebook.com/Sarat and Murciano, and we welcome your comments, too. But remember, I can't stand criticism, especially if it's justified.
Well, you're getting a lot of criticism.
I know.
You are.
Also coming up on the broadcast, we'll talk about this horrible video that ISIS released. And I guess has it been confirmed yet? It purports to show the murder of that Jordanian pilot. They burned him in a cage. And we need to know that we're going to do something about this, or we're getting some good intel on these murders. And the person who kind of has a great pipeline to the Pentagon is an NBC News advisor, former Medal of Honor winner, Colonel Jack Jacobs. And the colonel will join us to talk about this situation at about 10 to 2 today. At about 10 to 2 or so, we'll check in with him. A little later, we'll commemorate the 3rd of February, this day, 1959, Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens perished in that plane crash. And Chicago radio and TV personality Bob Hale, before he came to Chicago, was working in the Iowa area on radio, and he emceed the last show they did. I think it was called the Winter Dance Party Tour, and they were all on the same bill in Clear Lake, Iowa, at the Clear Lake Ballroom, I believe, on, I guess it would have been February 2nd, 1959, and Bob Hale emceed that show, spent some time with everybody, and has some fascinating stories to tell about it. So we'll check in with Bob at about 2:08 today.
That's going to be so interesting. I can't wait for that.
And I believe our new feature is ready to roll here now. And shall we get to it right now? Do I need to say anything other than Havana-born Marianne Murciano now brings you breaking Cuba news. Here we go. Is this appropriate for breaking Cuba news, really?
I don't think so.
We'll go with it anyway.
Celia Cruz.
What's the breaking Cuba news today? Stop dancing and give us the breaking Cuban news.
All right. Photographs of former Cuban leader Fidel Castro, who's 88 years old, have appeared in official media for the first time since August. We will post that on our Facebook page because everyone wants to know whether he's really still alive. It shows him slightly hunched over while seated, but appearing animated as he spoke with a student leader. Speculation over his health has intensified since the historic December 17th announcement that his younger brother, Raul Castro, and President Obama talked about restoring diplomatic ties. And let me remind you that Raul Castro's latest comments are casting a doubt over whether anything will actually change.
Are we going to hear from Brother Raul?
Yeah, right now.
Okay, stand by as we bring you breaking Cuba news and Raul Castro. By the way, I saw the picture of Fidel, and he's gone hip. He's got his shirt untucked now, I notice. Anyway, here's Raul. Are you going to translate this?
No se devuelva el territorio ilegalmente ocupado por la base naval de Guantánamo.
So basically what he's saying is that nothing will happen unless the trade embargo is lifted, and nothing will happen unless
this music stops. No,
keep
nothing
going
will
with
happen.
The music.
What?
Nothing will happen unless Guantanamo base is returned to Cuba, and nothing will happen if there is no compensation for the people of Cuba for everything they lost because the embargo was on. And I would say to that, I would add to that, give me back my parents' house.
Yes, I'm sure.
How about all the confiscated stuff? Are you going to give that back?
I'm sure a lot of people want that.
I want to know if everything is going to be returned to us.
All right.
And then we can compensate them. How about that?
And there's your breaking Cuba news. Is Raul still babbling in there?
Yeah, he's...
Fidel, he was famous for talking for like 7 hours,
seven
right?
7 hours, yeah.
And is Raul trying to do that too?
Raul is a little more boring than his brother.
Meaning he talks less or more?
He talks less. Thank God he cuts it down a little bit. Yeah.
Let me see that picture of Fidel again that we're going to post. He's got his shirt untucked. So he's gone
and there's
grunge.
His wife. His wife is standing right next
to him. Doesn't
he
have more than one wife?
I don't know. I think it just he's had a lot of different people
it looks
over the
like,
years.
It looks like an Adidas jacket that he's wearing.
It does look like that, but I didn't want to say that because I'm not sure what it is. But he likes to be in his comfy clothes.
Yes, I see that. All right. Let's see. A couple of things to mention regarding the mystery name contest, or as some people refer to it, the name game. Pete McMurray and producer Scott Miller tried to break into our safe. You know, we have a name on a post-it note in our safe, and occasionally we play the game. We try to send you a psychic vibration as to the name in there. It's a person, could be living, could be dead, but a person known far and wide. And if you guess the name, you get the safe. You get all the prizes that the station is giving away on any given day. Today it would be various restaurant gift cards and everything in our office prize closet. That's the swag we accumulate that builds daily. There are shirts and hats and food items and CDs and DVDs, many, many books. So it's a big prize package, the largest prize package in the history of Chicago radio contests. Not in dollars, in volume. But anyway, Pete tried to break into the safe last night.
And what is wrong with
look
those
at the safe.
Two?
It's,
what is
it's
wrong?
In perfectly good shape.
He, what is wrong with those two
Pete and
young
Scott?
Men? Yeah. What is wrong with them? They actually tried to break
Wait
in.
Wait a minute. Our
what,
producer.
Did they use like a hammer?
Ann Johnsos has details. What happened?
They took a sledgehammer to it. You can hear it. And in fact, maybe we'll post that on our page too because there was a sledgehammer involved. Wendy Snyder was at home and almost called in to tell him to stop.
Oh, really?
Hey, let me tell you something about that safe from the Stack-On Company in Wakanda. They supplied that, and it is the elite executive fire-resistant safe. So if they want to set fire to it tonight, they can try that, too.
It's obviously sledge-resistant, too, because there's not a mark on it.
No,
I don't see anything.
It won't open up. It's worth more than $500, and it guards that little post-it note with the name. By the way, I thought of another clue.
No, we're not giving clues.
Well,
No.
It's
Let's not give clues.
It's not a direct clue.
Oh, please. You better run this by me before, off the air.
All right, I'll tell you what. We'll take a break, and then we could do it like I've Got a Secret. I can whisper it to you, then we'll show it to the folks at home. Was that the show they did that on? Anyway, I'll tell you what. During the break, I'll run this past you, Marianne.
Okay.
And then
I
think you'll agree that it would be okay to give this particular clue. And then we'll do that.
I don't think we should give clues. The only clues should be the names that have already been said, and we've said that's not it.
The ones that were guessed already, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I think there's a little something else I may want to put out there just to get people thinking.
Do it cyclically.
Stand by. I say WGN-TV. Oh. Now, we've said in the past about the mystery name contest that the name, what did we say in the past about it, Marianne?
We said that it is in some way, whether near or far, it would have some kind of a connection to us. That's the only clue we've ever given.
All right. And I was just going to elaborate on that a little bit. Can I say it? What I
sure.
told you during the break.
Yeah, that's not elaborating.
Well, I was just going to say that when and if the name is guessed, when you find out the name, it will make sense to you.
Okay, now stop.
It will make sense to you that we. Okay,
well,
I'll stop
that's
right
exactly
there.
The same thing.
Well, kind. No, it's you know.
Stop little, it. You know what? You are the kind of person that, like, if you buy a gift for somebody, you cannot keep the secret. Like, you have to tell, right?
No, I'm good at keeping a secret.
You know, are bursting with giving clues.
No, I'm good. I didn't tell my I didn't tell my parents I was in broadcasting until a couple of years ago. Dina Baer is over at WGN-TV, and she's on the medical watch for us. Hi, Dina.
Hi, Dina.
Hi, Bob and Marianne. How are you?
We're good.
Great.
And we're ready to hear about, among other things, risky sexual behavior. Tell us about this.
Wow, a real troubling trend. Sexual behavior among female students has gradually become more risky. So there are a number of statistics I'm going to throw at you, but you'll realize how bad this is. In 1989, the average age girls first had intercourse was about 18. Now it's 16 to 16 and a half. Hmm. The number of sexual partners back in 1989, 4. Now it's 12 for teenage girls.
That's,
you mean
that's
during what years?
That's frightening.
Like 4 or 12 while they're teenagers?
While they're teenagers, 13 to 18.
Oh, jeez.
Anybody have any insight as to what's behind this?
Well, there's one more I want to give you before it gets even worse. So condom use has decreased now. So it used to be more than 50% of girls would protect themselves or use protection during intercourse, and now only 40%. They just say they're not needing it. And they have made no reason, given no reason for this. They're just saying that this is what the girls are admitting to, and they see it as a reason for certainly parents and other educators to talk to young girls about the dangers of certainly unprotected sex.
Yeah, I wonder if some of this follows the sort of decrease in news coverage of the AIDS epidemic, and also follows the advances we've made treating that disease.
Right. It used to be considered deadly, and now it's just a chronic disease that people live with for years and years, certainly, so there's less of a fear about it.
There's a story in the news about our chronic problem of not getting enough sleep. What's the latest on this?
Well, not only is it going to cause other problems in your body, but now it turns out if you don't get enough sleep, you won't be as strong. So our bones get sleepy as well. Bone turnover, which is critical for bone health, apparently occurs while we sleep. So sleep duration and quality impacts our oxygen levels, it impacts inflammation, and that can alter bone regeneration. It's just another reason to really address some of these sleep disorders. I know people will live with sleep apnea. That's when people gasp for air at night. If you live with someone who has it, you know it, because they're snoring and they wake up gasping. And that is a huge heart threat. But now, as it turns out, it's impacting bones as well. So as you get older, that's going to be a real problem.
Yeah. I like this story about big box retailers such as Costco, Sam's Club, BJ's Wholesale, and Walmart, along with full service and fast food restaurants being key contributors to the nation's obesity epidemic. But is that a surprise?
I don't know that it's necessarily a surprise, but you do realize that it's sort of the way in which all of the food is presented to us. So you hinted at this. So Costco, Sam's Club, all of these places contribute to the obesity epidemic. And the idea is when food is cheap, it's readily available, it's offered in these massive quantities, then consumers kind of lose their concept of serving size and moderation. And even after accounting for some of the changes in exercise and other weight-related behaviors like smoking, researchers still found that overall the changing nature of retail is literally changing our figure.
Yeah, we're a supersized nation here, aren't we?
It's really true. Dean Richards just did a story about the movie theater out in Woodstock, and he saw these little tiny seats back from 1927 when the theater opened, and it was like no one would fit in them today. Yeah. But that was the average size back then.
Yeah, the bodies are getting larger, the portions are getting larger.
And it's not funny because it's leading to a lot of health-related problems and a real burden on our healthcare system.
Of course it is. And it's not just the amount of food that it's sold at these places. It's what's how the food is made, how the food is manufactured.
Food. Right.
Finally, this is interesting because in the Surratt household, there's a debate going on concerning our 14-year-old daughter about whether to continue piano lessons. And
Dina has
a story that may, that may help convince her to keep with it, I guess. Huh?
We just made the decision. Yeah. Music keeps your mind sharp, and not just during the time that you're playing, but well into the future. So tell her that. Scientists have found some of the strongest evidence yet. Musical training. learning in the younger years can prevent the decay in speech and listening skills later in life. So older adults who had musical training as a child were 20% faster in that processing in their brain, identifying speech sounds than their non-musical peers. It's in the journal Neuroscience, and as long as they begin some sort of musical lessons by 14 years old. So she gets in there. Tell her to stick with it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So wait, where can I get this story to so that I can email it to her and she can read the whole thing?
The journal Neuroscience.
All right.
I can send you a link, man.
Yeah, send it to me, would you?
Yes.
Thanks.
Dina
Bear
in the WGN-TV newsroom with the Medical Watch. Thanks, Dina.
All right, thanks, guys.
Talk to you next week. Not to worry, Steve. We'll get into the weather right now with Mr. Weather. And what's happening with the snow? What's the updated forecast? Tom Skilling has all of that. How you doing, Tom?
Good, good, Bob and Marianne. Good to talk
Hi
to you
there,
guys.
Tom.
How are you guys?
You know what?
Doing well after the big blizzard?
Yeah, we're okay. I wonder, Tom, could you have been a TV weatherman in a place that has no real seasons like Los Angeles or Miami?
You could have done hurricanes in Miami. No problem.
But you know, how often do those happen? I'd have to have something going on, you know? They called me one time years and years ago saying, would you ever work out on the West Coast? And I said, you know, I don't think so. They're big markets, but, you know, what are you going to talk about?
Yeah.
I remember I heard the KNBC weatherman at a weather conference saying, you know, the most exciting thing we do is we watch the inversion layer go up and down, which is a weather joke. But, in other words, there isn't much happening out there. You know?
You're in the right city, and we're all the better for it. But
well,
you'd definitely be bored elsewhere.
I would. I'd die of boredom. I've got to come in here. And, you know, I worked 1 year in Jacksonville, Florida, and that was enough of that as well. First of all, the heat and humidity got me. But secondly, I'd sit down there, and I'd see these storms going across the Midwest, and I thought, what am I doing sitting down here wondering whether there's going to be a 20 or 30% chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon tomorrow, you know? It was pretty boring.
I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah.
So, everybody.
So, Tom, should we be afraid?
No.
For today?
Never be afraid.
Never be afraid, Marianne. Okay.
No, there's a little clipper-type system coming in, and there'll be another one tomorrow. This one will kind of favor the northern half of the area, and the one tomorrow that will send a little snow through here by late morning and afternoon, and that favors the southern suburbs. And between the two of them, the one tomorrow looks a little heavier. But if you are driving, say, up by the Wisconsin line or up into Wisconsin, this thing coming through this afternoon will last. It's moving into northwest Illinois, southwest Wisconsin right now, the snow is. And they're warning folks that they may have a brief period, maybe 4 hours of moderate to heavy snow, which will lay down about an inch or two and then, depart the area. Actually, up there, they could get 3 or 4 inches in spots in Wisconsin.
So in the Chicago area, what time does the snow begin, do you think?
It looks like, anytime after 3 o'clock, and again, we're favoring the northern suburbs. I think folks down south may just see the disk of the sun fighting through the clouds and maybe get a flurry or two early tonight. But if you're in the northern half of the area, counties adjacent to the Wisconsin line and north, there you'll have snow 3-4 o'clock, and it could go on for several hours. And then it wends its way eastward, and the snow winds down, turns off for a while, and we'll wait for that second little wave to come up through the southern suburbs up to the city late tomorrow morning and early afternoon. And between the two of them, we'll get a dusting to maybe 2 inches in spots.
Oh, well, after all, it is winter. And I'm wondering, where do you stand? How do you weigh in on Bob's unscientific prediction that it's going to be a very, very mild winter?
Well, it was a warm January, wasn't it?
Yeah, the winter has actually been milder than a year ago. We were, I haven't checked the number just in the last couple of days. We've had a couple other things going on, but we checked last week, and we were running 7 degrees warmer than winter last year. We have half the ice on the Great Lakes. The snowfall had only been about a third. So I'd say I'd give the Surratt winter forecast an A-plus here.
Okay, really, so far so good,
that's
Bob.
And I offered him a job here in the weather office.
Yeah.
Hey, if this afternoon gig ever falls through, guys, come on over to the Action Weather.
I'll remind you of that. Now, is this right that if the temperature the other day was just a couple of degrees warmer, we would have gotten a big rainstorm instead of a snowstorm?
Oh, we were deeply in the cold air. The one thing, and it was almost a joy as a forecaster, you weren't worrying about where the rain snow line was going to set up across the area. That usually is one of the big You know, wild cards when you're forecasting big snows, because we climatologically tend to be near the rain snow line in these storms. But this time, the rain snow line was way downstate. Hmm. So in central Illinois, safely out of our area. That's what I qualify as way downstate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we never had any fear, Bob. We could have boosted the temperature a couple degrees and still kept it as snow.
And what do you think of the big controversy in New York about big blizzard that never happened there?
You know, look, that storm was actually pretty well forecast. If you'd gone 30 miles east of Manhattan, everything that was supposed to happened. 20 inches plus snow, whiteout conditions, hurricane force wind gusts, and then up into New England. I mean, that area was lambasted by that storm. What happened there was New York sat on the backside of the snow area, and that's a dicey place. I question whether 20 or 30 inches should have been forecast, or whether the term historic should have been used in the New York area, knowing how close it was to that backside. But, you know, when you stand back and look at the complexity of these winter storms, I really feel for the forecasters. I know some were on apologizing for it. I think you apologize when you've been negligent in some way.
Sure.
In that case, I think that was an education, you know, a moment to educate. And that is that, hey, these storms have sometimes a distinct cutoff on the west edge of the snow, and it just happened that thing was 30 miles east of where we thought it would be. Actually, it was about probably 40 or 50 miles, because New Jersey missed out on it as well.
Yeah, that's pretty close, but here's the problem. The folks in Manhattan, they think the world just sort of...
revolves around them.
Yeah, the sun rises and sets on Manhattan, and that's it. There's nobody else.
Well, you know, Bob, that's the problem. I grew up as a kid. You guys had me talking to cousins and Brucey a couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
Which was one of the highlights of my broadcast career. And, I grew up for a time, and I lived in New Jersey. And, you're right. I mean, when people heard I was moving to the Midwest, they said, all you're going to see is corn, you know.
Yeah,
and
west of the Hudson, that doesn't exist over there.
You know, hey, come on, give us some
credit. And as you point out, the big snow did hit all around the area.
All around.
So, yeah, it is kind of an unfair
criticism. It was really amazing. I was looking at some of those central and eastern Long Island numbers, and, I mean, had you picked up Manhattan and moved it literally 30 miles east, everybody would have been, you know, real happy about in terms of it, you know, panning out the way they wanted.
But also, it's impossible for it to be a completely exact science, right?
You know, think about it. Part of the problem is we incompletely sense the atmosphere, and we're making a lot of assumptions. You know, when you describe to a computer model what the atmosphere looks like so it can apply the physics and tell you where everything's going and where stuff's going to develop that isn't there yet, or stuff that's there is going to fade away, you produce data for grid points. There are 2 billion observations that go into a global computer model forecast, and that number will quintuple in the next couple of years. 98% of that data comes from satellites, but if you're on a commercial aircraft, there's a transponder on many of these planes that's uplinking weather information without human intervention as the plane flies. So we get a lot of transoceanic reports that way. We have buoys out there. It's just a whole group of things. And the first thing that you do is you take all that data, you dump it into a computer and say, all right, describe the initial state of the atmosphere. Where is everything? And you're making assumptions between the data points where the observations are taken. So it'd be like, you know, if you have an observation in Chicago and one in DeKalb, you've got a lot of atmosphere between there. And so you come up with schemes to tell the model how to estimate what's going on in between the actual observations. And what they're finding is if you tell the computer, hey, take 20 cracks at filling in all these data void areas, and then we'll run each one of them as a separate forecast, and then we'll average all the forecasts together. And that's what we're doing now in this day and age of super high-speed computers. This machine that runs the weather forecast models we look at now does 200 trillion mathematical calculations a second.
And I know you, Tom Skilling, go through each and every one of them.
Absolutely. I sit here.
That's why
I
count on you.
That's why my hair is falling. Bob,
More of Tom Skilling, WGN-TV, Channel 9, and he's going to get ready now for 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Actually, it'd be better to run a commercial for you guys and a promo. Just mention the times WGN-TV News is not on the air.
That's true.
Yeah, it'll be a lot easier.
We're fast. We're going to put condos here in the building, and all of us who work here, you know, are just going to sleep here. So, the morning crew is practically doing that right now.
Yes, they are. Done. Tom, appreciate you. Speaking to us for a few minutes today.
Oh, great to talk to you, Bob and Marianne. Yeah, you guys have a good one.
You too. Talk to you down the road.
You bet.
Some horrible news today. ISIS militants releasing a video purporting to show a captive Jordanian pilot being burned alive in a cage. 22-minute video that our government is, of course, trying to authenticate as we speak. And this is so sickening. It's beyond belief. We're all upset about this, and we need to know more, and we need to know what, if anything, is going to happen in the wake of this. So we've asked NBC News military analyst Colonel Jack Jacobs to join us, the Medal of Honor winner, and you see him on MSNBC and NBC News all the time. Colonel, I'm glad you could spend a few minutes with us to talk about the latest news. And I guess my first question on this is, how much are the ISIS videos analyzed by the Pentagon?
They're analyzed very closely, and they try to use not only the archival footage, but also try to find out what the electronic signatures are and correlate that with any satellite or overhead imagery we have to determine whether or not it's accurate. And most of the time they can do that fairly quickly.
But at this point, I mean, it sounds like the parents have already seen the video. I can't even imagine that. And been able to authenticate the, you know, the fact that it was, you know, that it was the pilot. And at this point, I mean, it's, you know, like, what do you do?
Well, the short answer is pretty much nothing. Your options are like threefold. One is to do nothing. I mean, we're not in a position to do anything, and I don't think we have the political will to do anything concrete over a long period of time, which is what you really need to do to defeat these guys. Second, you can pay ransom when it's asked for, or do deals when they're asked for. And what we've discovered over a long period of time is that that doesn't work either, because it just engenders more situations in which we have to do deals and pay ransoms. So not just we, but lots of other countries refuse to do that. Clearly a great loss. The result is terrible. But the possibility of having this kind of thing happen again and again is not particularly tasteful. So neither we nor our allies, generally speaking, do any deals with people like this. The third thing is to make a real commitment to destroy ISIS, and that requires a political commitment I think the American people, and certainly our politicians, are not willing to make, because it means not just lots of people, it also means lots of time, and I think our political apparatus has already decided that we want to bail out of that area.
But the fact that we're seeing more of these videos, the beheadings, and now this horrendous video, he's in a cage, burned alive. I mean, that has to sway public opinion, and by doing that, our political leaders as well. So don't you see that changing?
Well, I would like to say yes, but I think the answer is no. I think we've made a decision politically in this country that we're going to let other people, or we're going to force other people to fight. The question is whether or not we actually have a dog in this fight. I would say yes, but most people who go to the polls say no, because people get elected time and time again, often on a plank in a platform that says, we're going to let other people fight for themselves, and we're not going to fight for them anymore. I mean, just witness what we're doing in places like Afghanistan Iraq and Africa, where we have special forces and special operations forces, to be sure, but they're in the business of gathering intelligence information on the one hand and training indigenous forces to defend themselves on the other. We're just not willing to make that commitment. I mean, as a matter of fact, our army is about ready to be smaller than it's been since before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. I think our motivation to go after bad guys, even if we had a strategy to do so, which we do not, our motivation to do that politically is not very strong. And as horrified as we're going to be, and we are, and we will continue to be over incidents like this, I don't think it's going to be enough to get the American public to chime in and say, yeah, I'm willing to put the uniform on and go beat these guys up, because we've seen exactly the opposite.
How did these huge amounts for the ransoms get started? Was that France that paid at one point, and that's how the amount was pretty much determined?
Well, we know that the Italians have paid before. Indeed, some other countries have paid before, have paid negotiated settlements that were far smaller than what was demanded in the first place. But it's interesting to note that despite the fact that ransoms in the past have been paid, that hasn't changed the frequency of captives, people being captured, and either held for ransom or later executed. So, there's an old saying on Wall Street, you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. And so if you ask for $6 billion, $1 trillion and somebody pays it, they've just set the price.
Yeah.
This will continue as long as nobody goes after these guys.
I want to believe that we're gathering some good intelligence on these murderers. Do you think we are?
Yes. That's the half the answer. The other half is not enough. In order to get really good intelligence, we have to have good human intelligence. We're great with overhead stuff, with aircraft, with satellites, with electronic eavesdropping. We're really good with all that stuff. But what we don't have is really good intelligence on the ground, human, what they call human intelligence, or human, in order to verify the stuff we gather by other means. It's not good enough to have some intelligence. You've got to have some intelligence that's A, complete, and B, verifiable. It's the verifiable part that we have some problem with, because we don't have people on the ground. We don't have a lot of people on the ground. And when we do have people on the ground, we can't trust them necessarily. And so verifiable intelligence is hard to come by. And when we do get it, it takes a long time to get it. Take a look at the mission to go get Osama bin Laden. We weren't even sure when we went there that he was there. We had some degree of confidence, indeed a high degree of confidence, that he was there. But he'd been there 4 years, and it took us – and that's a high-value target. Think about middling targets, just general thugs, and you realize how difficult it is to try to get these guys. Let me just say, if we've got a minute or two, on the other side of the argument, and that is that ISIS, unlike al-Qaeda, is very well organized. They're hierarchically structured, and what they're looking to do is to seize terrain, which means they're going to have visible headquarters and troop formations. So they're easier to get than al-Qaeda was. The bad news is, like I said, we're not highly motivated to go get them. I mean, we're doing strikes, but if a lot of them are in Syria, we're not going to go get them, because we've already made a commitment that we're not going to go after targets in Syria. I mean, and they already know this. So it's a real difficult problem. It's what you really want to have happen militarily intertwined with what we don't want to have happen politically. And it's difficult to come to a conclusion in that regard.
Yeah. As you say, I mean, the pendulum has swung away from the desire to get more boots on the ground. It's a very troubling story. As always, we appreciate your time. Colonel Jack Jacobs, NBC News military analyst. Thank you, Colonel.
You're very welcome, Bob.
Thanks.
The Day the Music Died. Don McLean sang about it. and American Pie. And it was on this date, February 3rd, 1959, that the plane crash happened near Clear Lake, Iowa, killing Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and J.P. Richardson, the Big Bopper, along with the pilot of that small plane, Roger Peterson. The Winter Dance Party was the name of that tour. And the night before, on February 2nd, that was the last show that those folks performed. And it was at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. And the MC of the show that night, Chicago radio and TV personality here in the 60s and 70s, and before he made it up to the big city, he was working in that area, DJ Bob Hale. And Bob joins us now to talk about the day the music died. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, folks. How are you? How's the husband and wife team doing?
We're surviving. Yeah. We're still together. We're happy.
Yes, we are.
That's marvelous. That a happier, more beautiful husband and wife team in broadcasting, I do not know.
Oh, very nice of
well,
you to
and
say
you're,
that.
You're
you.
Sounding good, Bob, and I know, I think...
I say that only because I want to be treated nicely.
I'm glad you pointed that out. over the years, you've appeared around the country talking about this. Do you ever get tired of telling these stories?
I guess not, because, well, in a way I do, because I catch myself starting to sound rote, like I'm repeating what I said a week ago, a month ago, 5 years ago. But, no, I think it's important to keep the story alive, because these three guys were pioneers in the kind of music they were singing. None of the three sounded alike, sang alike, had the same style, and I think they were pioneers and need to be remembered for what they contributed to popular music.
Let's see if we have this right now. The tour actually started sometime before the ill-fated date we're talking about. I believe it was in Milwaukee on January 23rd of 1959. And take me to the date that you got involved, Bob, with the Winter Dance Party Tour, February 2nd.
Yeah, but I say we. That means the Surf Ballroom and KRIP Radio in Mason City. I was afternoon and mid-morning DJ there, and I had a weekly record hop at the Surf Ballroom. Carol Anderson, the manager of the ballroom, called me one day when I was on the air, and he said, I've just been given a phone call, just received a phone call that we could have Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Booper here. I said, no, Carol, that's the Big Bopper. And he said, and a guy by the name of Frankie Sardo, and I said, who? And even after I met Frankie, I said, who? And Frankie admitted he wasn't going to go far because he really didn't like what he was doing. But Frankie had some, shall we say, questionable connections. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of required to go on the road. That's another story. Let's not get into that one here, but Frankie knew some tough guys. Anyway, he's on the road with these three guys. Carol said, would we get anybody at the Surf Ballroom if I booked the show? I said, yeah, book it, Carol, and let me know when I'll announce it. And 20 minutes later, he called back, and he said, it's booked. And he gave me the information, and we start promoting it. And the whole Winter Dance Party thing, if you look at a map, was excruciatingly stupid, because they went from east to west, north, west, back to east, circled. The bookers did not book the ballrooms in any particular order. They booked them in available dates. And so the guys are going back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, the story is out that they had a couple of bad buses, and it just was not going well. When they got to the Surf Ballroom, Buddy said, we have to leave the windows and the doors of the bus open. Our clothes are so full of sweat and perspiration, the bus stinks. And we need to get our clothes cleaned somewhere, too. So this was not a happy trip for these guys. Mm-hmm. And when they got to the surf that afternoon, we were already making the ground beef sandwich. What are we, sloppy Joe sandwiches? Mm-hmm. Which the surf, by the way, still make the sloppy Joe sandwiches. And some of the guys went out to the restaurant. Some of them stayed at the surf. There wasn't much to set up, bring in the instruments and some of the sidemen and practice a little. And one thing that sticks out is the manager was called me over and he said, listen to Buddy play on the piano. And Buddy's noodling on something. He said, there is going to be one of the most prolific musicians in popular music in the world. Now, Buddy had already done a couple of trips or a trip to Europe, so he was starting to become known internationally. And he's composing music, and he's doing it on the piano there. No sheet music, but he's, you know, eyes are half closed, and he's trying to create a new tune. And the guy said, they all agreed that this Buddy was a genius. And so there was a life cut short.
And,
sure.
And Bob, as I understand it now, so the performers, I mean, they're traveling around the Midwest in a bus. They're cold. I think, didn't some of them have the flu? Did we lose him there?
It sounded like we were beginning to lose the connection.
All right, we'll get him back.
Yeah.
As Bob mentioned, there was no rhyme or reason to the itinerary around the Midwest.
Right,
that
it
started
just,
in Milwaukee, January 23rd of 1959.
It was just whenever there was a flight available.
Well, they were on the bus. They were on buses.
Right, but yeah, it was random.
It was random the way they booked the tour, and then we'll get into this part of the story where they end up wanting to take a plane to the next gig after they do that show that Bob Hale emceed at the Surf Ballroom.
Is part of the reason that that they did that because it was a crazy schedule, because it was so random, it made no sense?
Why did they want to fly after the show you emceed, Bob? No, we're having trouble with that connection, I guess.
Thank you.
Oh, he's back. Bob, are you there?
Let's take a break, and then we will reconnect
right. Okay.
Everything and everybody, okay?
Okay.
Talking about the day the music died. Buddy Holly and J.P. Richardson, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens perished in that plane crash near Clear Lake, Iowa, in the early morning hours of February 3rd, 1959, after playing their final show at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake on February 2nd, emceed by Bob Hale. And we'll continue with him after this.
A long, long time ago,
this program for a special news bulletin. Three young singers who soared to the heights of show business on the current rock and roll craze were killed today in the crash of a light plane in an Iowa snow flurry. The singers were identified as Richie Valens, 17, Buddy Holly, 22, and J.P. Richardson, known professionally as the Big Bopper.
But something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie.
We're talking about that date. It was February the 3rd, 1959, and one of the original rock and roll DJs at LS, Bob Hale, at the time was in the Midwest working his way up in radio and emceed their final show the night before, February 2nd, at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. And we're talking to Bob about that night. And the question came up here, Bob, why, you mentioned everybody was taking buses throughout the Midwest. How come after the show you emceed on the night of February 2nd, 1959, they decided to fly?
Because the guys had dirty clothes. They've been in their showbiz clothes for 10 days, I guess. They wanted to get some laundry done. They were tired. And the bus, they're on their second or third bus. The heater broke down on one. The motor broke down on another. So these guys just wanted to fly. The three of them said, let's just get to Fargo a day ahead and rest and get our clothes clean. So it was sort of a necessity. And that's why some of the stuff found in the plane crash belonged to other members. of the performing group, and there was some confusion at first as to who really died in that plane crash.
Because of all the dirty laundry? You mean because of the dirty laundry that was in there that belonged to the other members?
Yeah, it was dirty laundry and also some money. And I think it was a billfold or something with somebody else's name in there, one of the other performers. And they was some confusion on the part of the coroner until Carol Anderson, Carol was the manager of the Surf Ballroom. He was called out to identify the bodies. And then Carol called me. At about 9:30 or 10 in the morning, I was doing the 9 o'clock to noon show at that point, and he called me to tell me about the plane crash outside of Clear Lake.
Bob, it's so hard to imagine this. It's so hard to imagine the fact that, these people were so young. You know, when you're, you're saying a 17-year-old, what was that like the night before with these, you know, their ages, I think, were 22, 17, and I'm not sure what Big Bopper's age was, but so young, what was it like working with them?
Well, first of all, you know, you expect you're going to have some trouble with young people and an ego. I can't recall in all of the years I worked, and even at the years I was here in Chicago at WLS, that I worked with more professional, considerate, focused people. The whole band, the three performers, the four performers, Dion and the Belmonts, everybody absolutely focused because this was their money. And Buddy was the boss. They had a road manager there who said, you watch Buddy, he's in charge. He takes care of the money. Buddy does the phone calls. Buddy does the booking. I'm having a good time. And Buddy was obviously the boss, and the feeling was that within a couple of years, you would see Buddy Holly as one of the most famous international stars. In fact, the road manager said, as he's looking at Buddy, noodling around on what was going to be another Buddy Holly tune, he said, I think Elvis better look out. Hmm. Everybody knew Elvis was on the way up, but he really felt that Buddy Holly was not only going to be a sharp performer, but he would be a manager, a creator, a producer, and he said toward just before the show started, that man is going to be an industry.
Hmm. Bob, you mentioned Dion and the...
You know, you feel that the next day. Go ahead.
Yeah, Dion and the Belmonts, Dion DiMucci was on the tour, so was Waylon Jennings. Why weren't those two on the plane?
The plane was originally booked by Buddy and Waylon, and it wasn't Dion. Maybe you can help me here, Bob, because you're so much younger than I, and I keep forgetting who booked the plane. But
Tommy Alsip was in the Crickets, and he was supposed to be on the plane, right?
Yeah, well, they had Buddy, of course, was going to be on there, and then I've got to figure who talked who out of what and who flipped the coin.
Well, I think it was it J.P. Richardson. J.P. Richardson ended up flying instead of Waylon Jennings, didn't he?
Right. And Big Bopper said, you know, I'm sick. I need to get on the airplane. And so he got on, and then they had the coin flip. And
That was the Tommy Alsip of the Crickets. He lost his place on the plane because he lost the coin flip, didn't he?
Right. But now the thing here is we see the Crickets. You know, those weren't the real Crickets. They were the traveling Crickets.
Mm-hmm.
Buddy had a slight falling out with his guys. And there was some effort for that to get healed. And so Tommy knew, as he told later, he said, I knew that I most likely was going to be just a temporary fill-in, and that Buddy and the guys would get back together. Everybody thought they'd be getting back together with Buddy Holly and the real Crickets. But, you know, two guys who lost out on that, Waylon Jennings and Tommy, how their lives were different. I talked to Waylon many years later when I was doing television in Kentucky, in Lexington, and he and I chatted for quite a while, and he had tears streaming down his face when he said, you know, I couldn't handle that. I couldn't handle that. I didn't know what to do. And he said, that's why I became a drunk.
Hmm. Well,
and then
yeah.
Tommy Alsup, and Tommy just took a deep breath and said, I have to go on.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's, it's unbelievable. Basically, because of a coin toss, Richie Valens is on the plane instead of Tommy Alsup. Yeah. And Waylon Jennings isn't on the plane because the big bopper talks him out of the seat because he's got the flu and needs to get off the bus. Unbelievable.
It's very strange. And the next day, that all goes through my head, what I'm saying, why? And then you say, well, wait a minute. Who do you, are you wishing two others were dead instead of these? And for a young disc jockey, this was an incredible kick in the stomach, because then I start thinking, how responsible am I? And Carol Anderson and I talked about it, and my pastor, who is still one of my closest friends, called me and said, how are you doing? And I said, I don't know. I don't know how I'm doing, because I was in a daze.
How could you be responsible in any way?
Well, because you guys were involved in the booking of the show. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And first of all, when it was, I took a buddy back to Carol's office at the break so he could make the call to hire the airplane. And you know, one of the first thoughts I had is, gee, maybe I shouldn't have done that.
No.
And then you get involved in who's going to go on the airplane, who's going to stay, and how responsible am I? And this was the biggest show I'd ever done as a disc jockey, because I was still very new at it. And Carol Anderson was in shock, not only because of the death, but he had to identify the bodies. And so when he and I would talk, it's just like we were two zombies. We were probably talking past each other.
Now, I can imagine. Are there any pictures from that night, Bob?
I had I used my wife's camera. I shot 16, black and white. Not one of them turned out. There are five pictures that are owned by a couple of guys. One of them today showed up on Facebook. I don't know if the picture's on loan, but the thing I don't understand, nobody understands. I shot 16 pictures, none turned out. Flash bulbs were going off all over the place that night. I would say 30, 40 kids had cameras. Only one set of film turned out, and there are only four or five pictures, and they're now privately owned.
What a story. The day the music died, February 3rd, 1959, and Bob Hale, the MC of the last show for Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Richie Valens the night before in Clear Lake at the Surf Ballroom there in Iowa on February 2nd. Bob, thanks for sharing some of your memories. It's good to catch up with you.
Thank you so much, Bob.
I would say it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to talk to you two guys. It's a tough subject to talk, and I will say this, Kathy and I, still shed a tear. One last thing, and I'll tell you how it's affected us. 2 years ago, when we were in Iowa together, we finally got out to the cornfield where the plane crashed. I could finally bring myself to go out there. I thought, until we got down on our knees to look at the memorial they have out there, and we both started to cry. So I will never go back out there. I can't do it. It was too painful. It still is. I can talk about it, but right now I'm going to go have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, no, really. And you were how old at the time?
22, 23,
wow.
I guess 24.
That's a lot to process at any age. Bob, stay well and stay in touch, will you?
Thank you so much, Bob.
Keep happy, you two. I love you both.
Thank you. We do, too.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
Okay,
Marianne's Celebrity Report to the Nation is on the air.
Thank you, Bill. Lit is sponsored by Hollywood Casino Aurora and Joliet. Let's head into the celebrity newsroom. Over to you, Marianne.
Thank you, Bob. Well, you knew this was going to happen. New reports that Bobby Christina Brown's drug... I'm sorry. Let me start all over.
Do you want to start the celebrity report again?
I'm going to start all over.
Well, hang on. Should we do the introduction?
You're taking a cue from me up here today.
Yeah, right. You know what, Steve? Mercury is still in retrograde.
Hold on.
Until
hold on.
February 11th.
Yeah. Wait a second. Everybody just remain calm here. Just remain calm. This is how the show works. This is how the show works, okay? You wait. You remain calm. There are cues. Then you start. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Bob. Steve, Mercury is still in retrograde.
Thank you, Marianne.
Now that we may speak. All those reports about Bobby Christina Brown's suicide attempt turned out to be accurate, as drugs were found in her house after her near drowning. And it does seem like she wanted to kill herself in a drug-induced suicide attempt. Police, the first time, did not find drugs in the house, but then they went back, searched the house a second time, and then they found some drugs. They were looking for drugs that were out in the open the first time around, and the next time around, they searched the house. And now there's word that the friend who helped her husband revive her, that he has had some trouble with the law related to drugs as well. He supposedly forcibly drugged his girlfriend weeks before so that she wouldn't run away. All sorts of stories are going to be coming out from this. Lance Armstrong has disgraced himself all over again. So say police, who claim that he hit two parked cars after partying in Aspen and then let his girlfriend take the blame. So his girlfriend is Anna Hansen. She initially told cops that she was the driver that night, but they didn't believe her. She said that she didn't want Lance to drive because he had been drinking. So then the story started to fall apart, and apparently the police contacted the valet company that worked the party where they were at that night. And the valet told the cops that he specifically remembered helping Anna into the passenger side and that Lance was the driver. Then she changed the story and said that they switched driving. And then finally she admitted that she had lied.
I saw another interview with him. I don't know where he was, maybe in England or someplace. No remorse, no acknowledgement that he's a big cheater and a liar.
No.
And if you see that documentary that was running, they'll show it again. I think it's HBO. The man is despicable.
I know. I agree.
And he let down so many people, and he conned so many, and he still shows no remorse.
And he let his girlfriend take the blame for hitting those two parked cars.
Well, that's obviously the kind of guy he is.
Yeah. Hey, get this. Diane Sawyer has scooped the Bruce Jenner interview from NBC. So Bruce Jenner is going to sit down with Diane Sawyer and talk to her about these changes before the start of the docuseries for E.
And that's embarrassing for NBC because I think they own E.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why it has caused internal consternation.
Yeah, I'll bet.
In NBC's news division. So we'll see what happens with that. Now is your chance to own Paul McCartney's childhood home if you want to buy the house in Liverpool. It's actually in the speak or spec, however they say it, neighborhood of Liverpool. It's hitting the auction block at a starting bid of $150,000. It's a three-bedroom terrace house, which the McCartneys inhabited from 1947 until the 1950s. Paul moved in there when he was 4 years old.
So the family moved to that house when Paul was four?
When Paul was four in 1947.
And I think they were there for a while. I think Paul was in that house for quite a few years.
They lived there from 47 until the mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that
means, see a picture of it? I'll post a picture of it on our Facebook
page. So does that mean
it's a simple house?
Paul was living there until he was about 10 or so?
Probably.
Is that right? What year did he move into the house with the family? In 47.
And he was four.
He was four, and the family lived there how long?
Until the 50s.
Okay, so the family was there, you know, 8 or 10 years. So he was there till he was about 12 or so. I'd like to buy that house and just sit in it. Maybe I it would help me think of creative things.
I think you can do that right here in the Showcase Studio at WGN.
I haven't had a good idea. Well, I did have one good idea towards the tail end of last year.
Which was?
I think it was the idea for the the mystery name contest.
Oh, yeah. That has been cooking in your head for a long time.
Oh, yeah. It's taking Chicago by storm.
It's a good idea. Uh-huh. Robin Williams' wife and children are battling in court over his estate. Why does this always have to happen? This is why you should really specify everything. But in this case, apparently he did. And his children, Zachary, Zelda, and Cody, are countering that his wife of 3 years is, her name is Susan Williams, is adding insult to terrible injury because she's trying to change the trust agreement and rob them of Robin Williams' clothing and other personal items that apparently, according to this agreement, he wanted them to have. So it's in the courts. Kanye West is going to be performing not once but twice during the Grammys. Once,
oh, yeah, that's Sunday night, isn't it?
Yeah, once with Rihanna and Paul McCartney performing Rihanna's new song. And then the second performance is kind of a secret. It's a never-before-seen solo performance. So we'll see what that's all about. And Taylor Swift will not be performing at the Grammys, even though she will be attending. She says that her life is wrapped up and entangled in the planning of her tour and that she just can't spend the time to do the things she needs to do in order to perform at the Grammys. But she will be, she's nominated for 3 Grammys and she will be presenting. And she'll also be dancing on the sidelines like she always does.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob, I wasn't going to use this story, but since you grabbed this paper out from right in front of me because you wanted to see the picture of Paris Hilton, here it is.
Yeah, she's got
Paris Hilton.
She's got what is she wearing on there? Not much, right?
She's got a robe on.
It's open, an open robe.
Apparently, there's a lot of talk about what she has done to her chest, and she posted this Instagram picture that shares a lot, but she's not saying much. So,
post it so everybody can see
what you were looking at.
Pardon me.
So everybody can see what you were looking at.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Are you distracted because you're looking at the picture?
Yeah. Stop. Put it away. Is that it for the celebrity report?
That's it.
All right. More at facebook.com/Serrato and Murciano. We'll open up the mailbox next. I just got to get a message to you. Hold on. Hold on. Your message is now on the mailbox. And a number of texts, and by the way, the text number and the phone number is the same here, 312-981-7200, and a lot of folks guessing the name in the safe via text. And one of the rules of the contest, not too many rules of this contest, you don't have to be the first caller or the seventh caller, but you have to call when we are taking calls. We're not accepting guesses in any other way, isn't that right?
That's right. And people are stopping us outside of the station and guessing, sending us texts, but they're not calling in.
No, they are calling in when we ask.
Yeah, they're not just those people who are stopping us are not calling in. And it does not count if you do not call in.
That's phone only.
All right.
That is correct. And I like the fact that a number of the texts referred to it not as the mystery name contest, but as the name game.
Oh,
It's catchy. Remind me to, you know what? If I buy Paul McCartney's house and sit there to get a creative inspiration, I have an idea for a song that I'll call the name game. Let me work. Remind me about that idea.
All right. Scott Miller is so obsessed with the safe that he's texting us.
Scott Miller, the producer of the Pete McMurray Nighttime Show?
Yeah, he says we are determined to get into that safe.
Yeah, they tried to break in last night with a sledgehammer. And by the way, boys, I know what you're thinking next. Let me remind you, the safe is fire resistant, okay? All right.
Really, do not try to set a fire in the Showcase Studio, please. 630 says, please put that link on your Facebook page. I am a piano teacher. And that was the story that Dina Bear from WGN TV had, that playing music, a musical instrument, at least by the age of 14, helps your mind stay healthy and active into your old age.
Mm-hmm.
808 says, from my perspective here in Hawaii, all I can do is laugh when I see videos of the snow fall and cold in Chicago. It's 77 here.
Don't rub it in.
I know. Don't rub it in.
Is that our regular long-distance listener?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think we've already sent a prize to that person. But for long-distance listeners of the day, we do offer prizes. But I think we'll limit it to, you know, one. You can't repeat on that, right?
Yeah.
And once you get a prize for being the long-distance listener, just sit out there in Hawaii and just be happy you're there and not here.
And by the way, the same person says Tom Skilling is lying. He'd rather be in Hawaii, and he's envious of us.
He was. He was just there.
He was. Yeah. 773 says Tom is the best weather guy, period. And
we know that. We know that.
Lori Roberts writes to us on Facebook and says, I hope you two talk about how badly Rahm is doing, taking care of plowing our side streets. Albany Park is a mess. I finally called the alderman's office to try to get our side streets plowed.
Yeah, a lot of people are upset because the city took care of the main arteries first, and now getting to some of those side streets, and it takes a while, and there's a lot of snow. But you can be sure with election season coming, City Hall will be getting on that soon.
Oh, yes.
And I believe we heard from Mike Belandic today that everything's under control, so don't worry.
That's right. A lot of comments, speaking of snow, on our Facebook page, where we posted a little video of you and me driving to work, and there was a lot of snow on our car, and it made a lot of people very, very upset.
Well, because I didn't clear off all the snow from, like, the hood of the car and the roof of the car, right?
Yes, and people were just saying, this is dangerous. You shouldn't drive like that. Please get that snow off your car before you drive. It's people like you I hate driving in back of. Your snow blows onto our clean cars that take time to clean.
I know, but
thanks.
I was just pointing out what not to do. The National Safety Council asked me to demonstrate what not to do.
I don't think so. 630 says, I missed today's argument segment.
Do we have an argument segment? I thought the whole show was an argument segment from noon to 3.
But I always bet on Marianne. So far, Bob has helped me to pay off my student loans and two cars.
They're wagering?
Yes.
Well, listen, I can help you right here. If you hear us arguing and you're thinking about betting, nobody ever lost money betting against Marianne.
You mean...
Right? Did I say it right?
Against you, you mean.
Betting on Marianne, right. Yeah, don't bet against her ever. Hey, we got to go because Roe's here. Let's talk to him after this. Well, Marianne, I think we will do some post-production on the Celebrity Report before we air it, get that straightened out, and then we can go home. Thank you for being with us. See you tomorrow at noon, and here's Ro Khan.
Thank you so much, Bob and Marianne. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago.
Oh, wait, we're not going to talk? What?
What? I thought
you
were just talking to me.
Now?
No. Oh, you too? Anyway, I was apologizing to everybody in the office upstairs today about something. I don't know what it was. And
no need to apologize.
I guess I did, you know, because I had some construction in my office, and I guess I left some dust or something. I don't know what happened, and everybody was.
And you came down here, and you thought, well, let me just put my head down and do the show. I'm not going to.
My old friends aren't going to be mad at me, and apparently,
I'm not mad.
I wanted to ask you something about one of your guests. Or one of your segments, and you're going to talk about Guantanamo.
Yeah.
There's this book out I started reading, the guy's diary who is a prisoner there. It's unbelievable. And if you read that, you start thinking, hey, maybe there were some things there that shouldn't have been going on.
Well, we are going to have Adam Kinzinger on. He's a congressman from the Chicago area. He's the southern and western suburbs, and all the way up to Rockford. I don't even know how that worked out, but you know, it's remapping. Anyway, the point is, he's also an Air Force officer, so he's very involved in armed forces issues and international issues. And he went down and toured Guantanamo. And last week, and he's talking to us first about this on radio. And it's a pretty interesting. He's a big security hawk. So it'll be interesting to hear what he says about the importance of that now. But the other question is, do you bring these people, the ones that we're not going to let go? There are some down there, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others. Are you bringing them up to the United States? to stand trial? Do we really want that?
Where do you put him?
And remember, there was this prison in Western Illinois that they were thinking about.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I say that if you leave him with Raul Castro.
You know what I say you do? I say you put him up in my office and finish whatever that construction job is.
All right. Now, Ro, you see, you had a smooth handoff to the news, but no, you had to babble and babble until you're late for the news. Oh, well.
Oh, Judy. Don't get mad at me, Judy.